song to the silly, 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 silly daddy song. But take your pencils and your crayons out. We're gonna make some comics, gonna sing about. No, it's not time for snack. You didn't eat your lunch food. I'm not being rude. I'm just teaching you to be a grateful dude. Started with one baby, called her Coachy.
Silly daddy, oh silly daddy.
And now she goes by Maria, she's the oldest of the three.
Silly daddy, oh silly daddy.
And then came little Luke, and Anna baby too.
Silly daddy, oh silly
Mama
daddy.
Knows it's just slapstick, but they've been known to throw a shoe.
Silly daddy, oh silly daddy.
Come on, sing along to the silly, 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 silly daddy song. So if you wanna have some fun, crack some clean jokes, you know we got time for that. And then we'll mix up the story, and we'll get all profound, and then we'll close it up with a nice big laugh. Silly daddy song, sing it during dinner.
Silly daddy, oh silly daddy.
Eat your vegetables and you'll be a winner.
Silly daddy, oh silly daddy.
Now it's time for bed, say a prayer, good night.
Silly daddy, oh silly daddy.
As I leave the room, the kids say, don't turn out the light.
Silly daddy, oh silly daddy.
Kids, the day is through, time to close your eyes. I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, are their replies. So if you wanna have fun and crack some clean jokes, you know we got time for that. And then we'll mix up the story, and we'll get all profound. Then we'll close it up with a nice big laugh. Silly daddy song, come sing along.
Silly daddy, oh silly daddy.
It's a silly daddy song, won't you sing along?
Silly daddy, oh silly daddy.
You know you can't go wrong with a silly daddy song.
Silly daddy, oh silly daddy.
Yeah, it's a silly daddy song and I wish you'd sing along.
Silly daddy, oh silly daddy.
Come on, come on, come on, come on. Sing along to the silly daddy. Silly daddy, silly, 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 silly daddy song.
That was the Silly Daddy theme song to go with the comic Silly Daddy. You're listening to Inkstuds, CITR 101.9 on yo FM dial, yo, from Vancouver, UBC. I'm joined by my good friend and co-host, an occasional troublemaker,
hey.
Colin Upton. And today our special guest is Joe Chiappetta. Do we have you there, Joe?
I'm here.
Excellent.
Exciting.
That was the theme song to Joe's comic, like I said before, Silly Daddy. And we have Joe here with us to discuss 16 years of Silly Daddy. Silly Daddy's Sweet 16. Am I correct?
That's right, yeah. 16 years ago, it's pretty much when I started doing the comic. It's hard to believe, but it's true.
So, the comic... The name and the birth date, I guess, coincides with your daughter, Maria.
Yeah.
Her 16th birthday. The comic started as something with raising her as a child, yada yada, to kind of reflect what you're going through as a parent.
Yep.
So, was Silly Daddy your first time doing a comic?
No, I did a couple others. I had done some in school, like grade school. Probably fortunately, none of those survived. it was about, I don't think I've told anybody this other than my kids who think it's funny, but my very first one was, I think, about a six-pager that I did during school, like grade school, maybe fourth grade, and there was a guy, basically it was like a ripoff of Nova, the human rocket, but he was propelled by gas. Like his own human gas, and that's how he would fly around. So that's really all I remember from the story, but I think, I don't know if my mom found him and threw him away, but those don't exist anymore.
Well, that's too bad.
I'd find that a lot more interesting than the actual Nova character from, is it the Marvel one with the big yellow, I don't know what they are on his chest?
Yeah, I grew up reading a lot of the Marvels. And so that was a pretty big influence. And then I also did something called Tough Horse and a couple other zines and things like that. And that's really where I cut my teeth. It's just making zines, putting stuff out. And And then, you know, when I had when I had the opportunity to be a parent, it was just so strange. You know, I was not trained to be a parent, and I didn't realize I actually could get help in being a parent, but I didn't. And you know, it just the first couple issues were really me trying to figure out what I'm doing as a parent, and then also as a cartoonist starting off a regular series. And that's how really the story grew out of just what is a parent, and what is a good parent, what's a bad parent, and where do I fall in. And boy, in the meantime, this stuff sure is entertaining, learning all these hard knocks.
So were you familiar with autobiographical cartoonists?
You know, I don't think I really... The only ones I knew were just guys that I grew up with in college that were also doing them. But I didn't really know that this whole genre existed. Like, you know, I went to college with John Porcellino. So we were in the same painting class. And, you know, he went on to do King Cat later. But I was a contributor to his Kosoiko zine. And, you know, he would... You know, we would trade zines and things like that, the ones that I was doing. And, I, you know, for all I knew, I was the only one doing autobiographical comics. And then people were telling me, oh, yeah, your stuff must be influenced by, you know, and they would rattle off these names. And I'd be like, no, I'm not sure who that is, you know. Is that like, did they appear in Spider-Man? You know, I was just a Marvel guy, you know, so I didn't know any of this stuff. And then gradually I got into Cerebus and... some of the other independents, but I never came across autobiographical stuff, and actually to this day I really haven't read much of it.
Harvey Pekar, the Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah, I'm not kidding. I was doing Silly Daddy maybe for 5 or 6 years before Dave Lasky said, hey, have you ever read Harvey Pekar? Who's that? I'm illiterate, what can I say?
Well, getting a recommendation, David Lasky, still you're in touch with quite a talented cartoonist in his own right as well. I got to give the Seattle boys some props.
Yeah, he's great. He's a great. I mean, well, this is what's weird. I know I'm kind of jumping ahead of things, but I was just telling Todd Allen this the other day. He's I don't know if you know about Todd, but he's probably one of the probably I'd say the most knowledgeable person in regarding webcomics business that I know of. He's brilliant. And we had lunch the other day, and he knew me back when, you know, back when I had long hair and was traveling around the country promoting the book. And I don't do that anymore because I have 3 kids, you know, a wife, and some responsibilities that I need to tend to here in Illinois. So we're having lunch, and he's telling me about all these people that I knew really well, you know, a decade ago, and, you know, how they're writing now for Marvel and DC, and they've got these deals, and I'm just like, this is incredible, because I had kind of withdrawn from not making comics, but the marketing of them a long time ago for quite a while, and I said, listen, this is what I feel like, Todd. I feel like Captain America, and his first response, he's like, oh, what are you, dead? I'm just like, no, that's not what I mean. I mean, because I didn't read that story either, so I don't follow those anymore. But I was like, no, you know how Captain America was like frozen, and you know then he's pulled out, and so he has to reconnect with all these people, and most of them he doesn't know, and that's really how I feel, kind of coming back into the industry from the webcomics angle. And being out of it, and then all these other people—they've morphed into successful cartoonists. And when I knew them, you know, I was wrestling with them on the beach, or they were sleeping on my couch, or we were driving cross country, you know, eating Pringle sandwiches. So that's kind of so I just feel kind of like pulled out of that into this. So that's where I'm at.
So it's quite a different comic book world now than it was when you're starting. Like, the whole zine factor just isn't really... Well, I guess there's mini-comics now. Mini-comics are pretty big, but it's just not the same as being, like, the only real outlet like it was, I guess, when you were starting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, with Well, that I think in about 2004, another college friend of mine, Mike Rendy, he said, hey, and he talked to some other friends of mine. He's like, hey, I put together this website for us, and we could post our drawings or comics or whatever. I'm just like, cool. So I started doing that sometimes once a day, sometimes once a week, or once a month. And I've been doing that pretty much all throughout the past couple of years. But I wasn't trying to, like, find out what other people were doing or anything like that. It was just kind of isolated. Because, again, you know, I'm raising kids. We have, you know, we've got, you know, some kids. We're also active in, you know, helping people in the church and things like that and helping people know about God. So it really wasn't a priority knowing what everybody else was doing. And so when people started talking about web comics and art comics, and I'm just like, you know, it just was so confusing to me at first, a few months ago when I got back into reconnecting with people. I was just like, comics are comics. I don't understand the difference. So it actually took a while for me to understand these definitions, and here I was doing them. You know, it was strange.
It's a learning curve of reintegration.
Yeah, it really was.
Now, we have your Silly Daddy book that you sent me to check out, and on the back of it, it says you were a wrestler.
Yeah.
So I'm going with a totally, like, you know, not related question, but what's the wrestler thing?
Well, you gotta understand, I'm, you know, Italian American, and, you know, we raised by Italian American father. He's a karate expert, ex-Marine, ex-cop, ex-boxer, PI, Vietnam veteran. I'm probably leaving out something, but so I got to do something tough growing up. So my dad got me and my brother into wrestling, not, you know, like natural libre wrestling, but actual, you know, wrestling with, you know,
Greco-Roman,
something like that. Yeah. It's been so long. I actually forgot the term, but so we did that, from when I was 70 pounds, I think in sixth grade, all the way through when I was 145 or 138 pounds back in high school, and we did that. You know, we liked it to varying degrees because, you know, it's being a wrestler is hard, and but you learn a lot about leadership and just, you know, pushing through things, and just it does toughen you up in some good ways. But I actually think I may have health problems because of it to this very day. But anyways, yeah, it really did train me to be a fighter. And that's where that comes in. And sometimes I am able to use that just for fun, playing with the kids, showing them moves and things like that. That's fun.
You were never tempted to go into a professional wrestling career?
No, I was always, like, decent, but I wasn't awesome. You know, like, I could hold my own. Maybe I could make it downstate, barely, but I was never, like, you know, the one that was going to win everything. I was the guy that beat that. I was the guy that got beat out, so to speak. So, yeah, I wasn't that good. But now with the comics and the drawing, that's another story. From an early age, people, they're like, wow, you've got a gift. You've got, like, you know, that's a gift from God. You need to use that for something. And so here I am, and I'm still using it. So I appreciate that I have been given that gift and talent. I don't always use it, I think, to the best of my ability. I think in college, and even today, in college there was a guy in my frat, he called me Joe the Sloppy Artist, because I was kind of sloppy with some of my art. But it still comes across as raw and just from the heart. And that's why... my favorite quote of somebody describing my work, because it's always interesting to see how other people view your stuff. And I would have never called my stuff crude, but Dave Sim, who does the Cerebus, he's like, your stuff is crude but amazing. And I was just like, wow, I would have never thought of my stuff as that, but you're totally right.
And Dave isn't one to often hand out compliments since his recent turn of... I guess activity is shown. So it's nice to get acclamation from Mr. Sim. Now, I guess college was really like the kind of developing ground for your artistic stuff. were you originally intending on really developing comics, or was it just something that kind of grew out of like kind of a community aspect with like John Porcellino and other people you're talking about that you knew in college then?
It was more the latter. I actually went to college for fine art painting, and you know, I had it all planned out that a year after college I was going to be living in a loft in New York and you know, paintings and making money, and I was going to be in the galleries. And here in Chicago in the Art Institute, I'm not kidding, I was so prideful. In the Art Institute, it's this, you know, it's a museum where the Picassos are, Monets, all the big time fine artists. Up along the top, if you've ever been to Michigan Avenue, the Magnificent Mile, where the Art Institute is, they have names of the great masters etched on top of the building. And I'm not kidding, I was convinced that my name was going to be up there within 10 years. And, you know, they would just, you know, etch out somebody else and just put my name, because they actually ran out of space. So
long name, though.
Yeah.
You've got to take a couple of names
up there. But that was my vision. And, you know, lo and behold, I get out of college and I'm submitting stuff to all these galleries and just pretty much rejection after rejection. And so in the meantime, just to distribute my work, I would put some of it in the zines. And you know, just send it out to people, and that got more reaction than my paintings. And so, you know, that kind of gave me a clue that maybe I have some other avenues to explore here. So then in the middle of that, it was unplanned that Marie was born, and so now all of a sudden I'm a father, and trying to figure out all that. And then just some amazing stuff happens that I just had to. I mean, I was compelled to share what I had learned as a inexperienced and foolish father, and you know, sometimes silly, sometimes just not funny at all type of father. And so I had to put that down on paper. And I'm just like, other parents have got to read this. People even thinking about being parents, they've got to read this, because I never thought this would happen to me. And so, you know, I wrote that down, and then more stuff was happening in my personal life that was just like, I can't believe this is happening. I got to write this. I got to draw this too. You know, and it just kept on going. And people kept wanting to read more. And so I kept making more.
Now, the title Silly Daddy is a bit of a misnomer then, because it's not really like a silly comic. It's a reflection of what you're going through. But I guess... you just kind of, is it the name coming out of yourself kind of feeling weird in the aspect of being a father?
Well, it's kind of got, it has layers to it. On the surface, the first time it was the term silly daddy was used that I knew of it in my life was when my daughter called me silly daddy. And there's a whole side of the comic that sometimes it's nothing but just silly, funny or surreal type stuff. So that totally fits. But then there's another aspect of it, and that's what gets into the, I get into that in the 2004 graphic novel, just self-titled Silly Daddy. It's a, kind of a big trade that I send you. And that has to do with silly as in just beyond absurd, but just flat wrong. So, you know, wrong daddy. And you know, if you just read the first issue, you see that, you know, just some of the things that I was doing as a father were just flat wrong. And that, so it always, not always, but when I got my head on straight, it reminds me of my pretty, you know, less than humble beginnings, where, you know, I really was blowing it left and right, so to speak. As a parent, as a father, as a husband, so things radically changed. As you know, I became more experienced as a father, and you know, learned a few things. And then in 98, I became a Christian, and that was another radical change. So there's these whole waves of just, you know, my own personal education, where it somehow feeds back into the book,
it either inspires people or it shocks them. And actually, in my case, I think it was both with many of the readers that I had.
I was wondering, your early comics started out as pretty much straight autobiographical comics, but there always seems to be some, not very far away, some element of surrealism or inner dialogue that happened in your books.
Yeah, and that's because I get a little bored with reality, so my mind is running faster than I can draw, and you know, like, I mean, even to this day, somebody's you know, talking to me, and I'm listening, but I'm also looking at the shapes and how the relations of the shapes, and just little things are flying around in my head, and it's hard to get it all down. So one of the things that I do to try to you know, capture some of that is pour that into the drawings, and so throw some surrealism in there, but also with enough discipline so that the story still makes sense. Like, I know some I've seen some surrealist films, and I've seen some paintings and things like that, and some of that stuff is just, like, I don't want just to be, you know, just people to look at myself and be confused, like, you know, who am I, what's going on, and just, there's no point. Like, there needs to be a point. Either it's, you know, just to express joy, or to really discover that, you know, the truth of life, or something important about being alive. But just to be surreal, just to be all weird and you know, shocking, I'm not really interested in that. I'm more interested in those kind of undefined moments of life that are surreal, but are also real, if that makes any sense. Like, mm-hmm. Almost like a hyper reality, where your senses are just so on that you're seeing things that maybe other people don't see, but they're still there.
I totally see what you're saying with that, because it seems that you like to exaggerate the figures a lot in the book,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I like to exaggerate, partly because I'm too, this is where the sloppy artist comes in, I'm too lazy to, like, I have been given the skills to, you know, do this all-out, you know, anatomically correct drawing, or even all-out perfectly proportioned cartoonist drawing where, you know, Charles Schulz would pat me on the back. But I don't have the patience, and I also have this expressionistic streak in me, so I just have to just slap it out there as quick as I can.
I think I'm going to play a song.
Cool.
And then I want to get more into the art talk, because it's interesting, because not a lot of comic artists necessarily have as much of the fine art background.
Oh, that'd be fun.
So, Ink Stud, CITR 101.9 FM. I am joined by our special guest, Joe Chiappetta, and we will be back. I'm going to play Mr. Spock by Nerf Herder.
And you
Inkstead, CITR 101.9 FM. That was Nerf Herder with Mr. Spock, a request by our special guest, Joe Chiappetta. Joe, why the Nerf Herder?
Well, there's also a strong science fiction vein in me, and I remember watching Star Trek with my dad, so that was pretty cool. And I think there's kind of a hyper-reality sense of Star Trek with the vibrant colors and the just a well-written show. And so I try to weave in some science fiction elements in many of my one-panel gags that I'm doing lately, and also in some of the Silly Daddy stories, kind of long science fiction arcs that also somehow are autobiographical. I'm somehow able to staple that in there, even though I never plan to be a science fiction writer, but the next thing you know, I decided to take 2 years off a few years back and write a science fiction novel, and that's what I did. And I'm still trying to figure out how I'm going to put that out. It might be called Star Chosen. Maybe I'll call it Silly Daddy in Space. I still haven't figured it all out yet.
It's like Muppets in Space.
The first couple chapters on the SillyDaddy.net website that I posted it somewhere. If you just search for Star Chosen, you'll probably find it too.
This is prose?
Yeah, no pictures. My wife keeps telling me, though, that I need to turn this into a graphic novel. I'm just like, I can't draw that. That's like 50,000 words. I don't want to draw that. So, but maybe she'll wear me down. I don't know. We'll see.
I had a guest a couple weeks ago who was had a book deal to do 30,000 words, I think the book was, or something.
That's a lot.
And he gave them a wordless graphic novel. It was a 350-page graphic novel, but it was wordless.
Wow.
Well, maybe there's about 30 words in it.
A picture says 1,000 words.
That's right. So he's cranking. Above and beyond.
Woo!
Well, I just wanted to ask, I was curious, how do you say sorry in Canadian?
You're asking me?
Well, in one of your stories, you have a little note where you're saying, said in a Canadian accent from watching too many episodes of Degrassi High.
Yeah, it's a big deal over here that I mean, to us in Chicago, you guys sound so funny. No disrespect.
But we're not that far from you.
Yeah, but you're talking about Chicago, where, you know, they talk like they're from Chicago.
Well, he's not talking like he's from Chicago.
I'll imitate how you guys say it. You guys say it sorry.
Sorry.
But we say it sorry.
Oh.
So,
uh-huh.
Yeah, there's other kind of fun things you guys do. I love talking to you guys because it's, you know, it's livelier than... You don't get that twang to things over here, so I appreciate it.
We have a twang?
Canadian twang?
Yeah, you know, like, you know, the way you say oh, and I can't imitate it too well, but...
out and about and about?
Yeah, when you say about is a big one. About, you know, it's just about.
About?
About.
Yeah.
No, it's funny, like, even going down to Seattle, the accent change can be quite pronounced. It's surprising, but it's like, you know, an hour's drive to get across the border.
Does everybody in the States watch Degrassi High? Picar, Harvey Picar watches it.
Really?
Yeah, he did a strip with Chester Brown, how he had to get off the phone because Degrassi High was on, and Chester went, ew.
I don't know if it's still on. This was, boy, this was probably 10, at least over 10 years ago, I think, that I had written about that. So I don't know if it's still on.
It's the new generation of Degrassi.
Yeah.
Oh, they still have it.
You see, they stopped it for many years, but now the people who are the students, 10, 15 years ago, are now the parents of Degrassi. Oh. And some of them are teachers. Joey's got a shaved head.
Wow.
I think he went bald.
That's brilliant.
Kevin Smith is also a big Degrassi fan, to quite the point that he...
He appeared on one, didn't he?
He directed.
Yeah.
He directed three episodes. They were god-awful. I watched them, and it was like... It was Degrassi. I don't know. I've never been a Degrassi fan, though. The ironic part, in Toronto, Degrassi, the street, I went there when I was living in Toronto for a little while. It's the ghetto.
Really?
It's like they show it on the show. It's like this really nice, serene area. And no, it's like, you know, worst part of Toronto.
Wow.
So, sorry to hear that.
Yeah. The irony of it all. Now, my favorite Silly Daddy story in the Silly Daddy collection is your trip to Rome. I think that's the first story in there, too, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my wife likes that one, too, about the red shirt father.
Mm-hmm. What kind of, the whole trip to Rome, did that have a really lasting effect on you?
Oh, yeah, that was just, well, it's so scary because Rome was just so incredible that I really felt like I didn't want to leave. I was there for 4 months. I worked out a deal with school where I was able to go there for school for 4 months in my senior year of college. And it was such an amazing place that I didn't want to leave, and then I pretty much vowed when I left that if I ever went back there, I would never come back. And just because of the light, the culture, and I was by the time I left, I picked up some Italian, enough to carry on a broken conversation, which was kind of cool. And it was just an amazing place, inspirational, and it was remarkable. It was very, and just the ideas flowed. Just walking down the street and then seeing Spider-Man comics in Italian, they're like giant size, like this like faded color, and Luomo Ragno was the name, and it was just really cool, you know. And then you're eating bread because that's all you can really. You're trying to save your money because you don't know how long it's going to last, and waking up early in the morning and buying squid at the market and making spaghetti and calamari. And it just, boy, what an amazing time. But it was just a dream world. And like, I imagine heaven will be somewhat like that. I really do.
Artistically, did you develop some new things while in Rome, like being influenced by the architecture and things like that?
There's really not, I wouldn't say stylistically, but I think what it ingrained in me was just more of a sense of, okay, this is, here I am. I'm totally, isolated from my home country, from all my friends. You know, I got to make new friends, and I'm in this amazing place. And it really helped me to understand that, you know, it's just like that old song, life really is what you make it. And so, you know, if I didn't wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go out to this bridge where they have all these cool statues and do some drawing, which is part of my training, then then the sun would rise, and then I would, roll up my canvas as they're just drying, and then go to school, get some more training. If I wouldn't make the most of it, I wouldn't have really had the, be able to, live that art experience to the full. That helped kind of being isolated and having to go halfway around the world to do that. That really helped.
The push and the drive.
Yeah, just that sense that what was really cool, it really gets, it was a lot like, like a comics convention in terms of you realize what's possible when
when people really just go all out with what they want to create. And sometimes it's a little scary because you can also get this kind of false sense of, I'm so great because I'm surrounded by greatness and I have skill and therefore I'm great too. And so I'm destined to do great things. And that can actually lead you down some false paths, I think, too. But so it was, in one sense, artistically, it was amazing and inspiring. But in another sense, it set me up, I think, for a fall in terms of for quite a while. I really thought that I can do anything, and I should do anything because I've walked under greatness. I've seen greatness. I've drawn greatness. I've created greatness, and therefore I'm great. And that was so wrong. And that spilled over into relationships I had, and I had to do a lot of backtracking years later, and do a lot of apologizing, frankly.
One thing I'm wondering about is what your daughter thinks of Silly Daddy 16 years later.
You know, I actually asked her if she wanted to be in on the interview. I know I didn't ask her, but she's not standing by or anything like that. But she at first really didn't know what to make of it because she really thought that it was normal to be in a cartoon because that's her dad, or the only, really role model she had for a father was me. So she just figured, well, it's kind of normal for your dad to be drawing pictures of you and reading out what you say and stuff like that. And then when she realized that that wasn't normal, she thought it was cool. And but there actually are still some stories that she hasn't read because some of the stuff I've done, like, I don't think it's so great, and I probably wouldn't want other people to read. The stuff I'm doing now, like the webcomics that I'm doing, kind of the daily challenge I have of doing a new one each day, that stuff's totally, I feel great about, and the whole family can read that. But some of the stuff I was doing, I'm not fired up to really show her. But in terms of what she thinks about it, I think today she likes it. In fact, she helps me out with some of the editing, and she's a great gauge. Like, I'll do a comic and I'll give it to her and be like, "Is this funny?" Or she'll tell me what, she's 16. She's got the pulse on what's cool and stuff like that. So that'll help me. And then sometimes she'll actually write. I also post, narrative descriptions of the comic when I post them on the web, and she writes those half the time.
Oh, okay.
And she types them up. So she's a great help. She's part of it. So but in terms of what she really thinks, sometimes you have to interview her.
I was just wondering, I've done autobiographical comics myself, and every so often you'll meet somebody who sort of knows you through your comics, and it's kind of odd because you never met them, but they know about you and your past. And I wonder, as a cartoonist, I know what that's like, but I'm kind of wondering what it's like for her. Do people actually come up and say, like, "I've been reading about you since you were, like, little"?
Yeah, I know her face will tell you what it's like when you look at it, because it's discomforting. it's unsettling, because here's this person and they're calling you your nickname from when you were five. And you're like, "Who are you?" her nickname was Coach and Coachy, and most of my readers know that and will call her that. "How's the coach?" I'm just like, "Oh no, she hasn't been called that." And but
Dad, why are they calling me Coach?
Yeah. So yeah, it's a little unsettling, but it's also, I know she also gets a kick out of it too. But as long as it just, the key is, and I didn't understand this at first, is I really need to be more disciplined when I was doing autobio comics about what I write about. In the very beginning, it was just, I would write everything uncensored, and did it make for cool comics? I'm sure it did. But there's also human beings involved that were hurt by some of the stuff that I wrote about. And I have a responsibility, you know, to try to be all things to all men and women, you know, and so I need to think about that too, and just be responsible, because, you know, if I'm doing a comic and my mom is ashamed, you know, or other people are, you know, don't want to read it because of what I put in it, I have to think about that, you know. I mean, I have to be respectful, and there's a way to do both, but I didn't know how to do that at first.
I just don't show my mom when she's in my comics.
Oh boy! But see, there's something about me, and maybe I'm just you know, sentimental. But there's something about me that I want approval from my mom. You know, I want to be able to show her something I make and be like, Mom, what do you think? Are you proud of this? Are you proud of your son? And you know, I still have that need, we'll see. This new crop of stuff I'm doing, I don't think she'll find anything wrong with it. So, but we'll see.
One thing I'm curious about with the Silly Daddy collection is I read that you did a bit of a revisiting or revisionist collection.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Well, again, so kind of my little what happened with that was I put out the Silly Daddies as basically as quick as I had to do them. I'd print them, self-publish them, promote them, get them out there. And then in 2000, this is since 91, and in 2004, I'm not kidding you, out of the blue, a publisher in New York contacted me, and they were like this international publisher of other things, and they were trying out a graphic novel line, and they wanted to do like what they called the definitive Silly Daddy collection, and they had money to back it up, so I said okay, and we went back and forth with the contract, and finally, when I was happy with it and I wasn't giving away the farm or anything like that, we signed it. And the thing is, though, since they had seen the work that was out there in New York, what they didn't know was that I had since become a Christian. So in good conscience, I could not support the promoting of my work that had swearing, that had, you know, just offensive stuff in it. I had to correct that. I didn't want now my daughter at the time, you know, she's 13 or so. So, you know, I don't want her, you know, reading this. I don't, you know, garbage in, garbage out, so to speak. So I had to go through and lay out all the pages in my basement. And okay, I'm going to take out all the swear words. Anything else? If there's anything else I need to tweak, I'm going to do it and try to, really try to put out something that I can feel comfortable with reading today. And the publisher was fine with that. They thought that was cool. I know my mom appreciated it, and my family did. I did get some flack from people. They're like, oh, you've sold out, you know, you can't edit your own work, and you're changing history, man. And I'm just like, you know what? It's whose work is it? It's my work. You know, didn't Da Vinci carry around paintings with him his whole life and change them at his discretion? And weren't there novelists that would, you know, revise their great novels every few years? And so cartoonists can't. So that didn't make sense to me. So I'm just like, I certainly can. I'm not denying that I used to be a foul-mouthed jerk, but I'm not anymore. And if I'm going to put my name to something today, I have to be responsible at what I do, because I don't answer to readers. I answer to God, you know. And that's where I was coming from with that revisionist mentality. And I need it.
Why the choice to change names?
To change name?
Yeah, I'd read that originally, John Porcellino was referred to as John in the... Or was he in the minis? Was he originally?
Oh, yeah. Actually, yeah, that's a good... I'm glad you brought that up. That's another thing. I got flack about that, too.
Because...
Somebody said... Because in the original... I think it was a science fiction theme. when the Silly Daddy story, there's a Silly Daddy story arc where it totally gets science fiction, but it's still, you know, me, my daughter, and, you know, other characters. And John Porcellino comes along for the ride, too. But, I make up all sorts of stuff because it's science fiction. Well, what happened was John, when I first was approached by Reed to put out the book, they're like, make sure if there's any real people in it, that you're using their name, make sure you get their permission. So most of it was my family, no problem, that was easy. But John and a few others, I had to ask, hey, is this all right? And so I contacted him, and, you know, we stay in touch, and he said, you know, I actually feel better if you change my name, because there's stuff in there, you know, that's, you know, not true about me, and, you know, I'd rather not be my name. You know, you don't have to change my likeness or anything like that, but, you know, change my name, I think that'd be cool. So I'm just like, sure, no problem. So I did that, and, here I'm thinking I'm being respectful to my friend, and he's going to feel good about this, and, he'll still get a kick out of it, because, he knows the parodies that I'm doing of him and things like that. Well, another reader is like, what are you doing? You know what, you can't own up to that you write about John Porcellino, and he had an attitude about it, and, I tried to respond to this reader that, you know, you got to understand, this is not... I'm not trying to revise things. This is a request from a friend, and it's certainly within my power to do that. He's my friend, you know, and I'm not gonna. If that's what he wants, it's not a problem for me. You know, I won't lose sleep at night over whether on page 100 or whatever, it's John Porcellino or whatever other name I made up for him. I can't even remember what it was, but I made up a funny name for him.
I think it was Al and the Family.
Publisher of Kind Cat.
I think that's funnier to me than John Porcellino, so I feel like it was an improvement.
Well, I think we were just worried that it might have been some sign of that you guys weren't getting along anymore.
Oh, I see.
I'd heard something like that somewhere. So.
Oh no. Yeah, no, we're still. In fact, I talked to him a couple of weeks back, and trying to get him to come back to Chicago because that's his home.
Yeah.
Well, Hoffman Estates, but he's in Denver now. So
now, he was a big supporter early on by publishing through what is it, Spit and a Half? That was his little publishing thing he had going for a while.
Yeah, well, he had like this distribution. It was basically a mini comic distribution that was Spit and Half, and so I would put out things, and I would distribute my mini comics through them. And basically, the first couple issues of Silly Daddy, I think it does say Spit in Half. That doesn't mean, though, that he paid for the printing
okay.
or anything like
yeah.
that. What it was this is my friend's publishing name, and I wanted to expand that. So I figured if I put my name on it, too, that would expand his awareness, his publicity and stuff like that. So I put Spit and Half on my stuff too, got his permission, and then we figured we could work together, and instead of people remembering, my name, his name, and Spit and Half, and then whatever I name my company, I figured, well, let me just use his name. And he was fine with that, and it was small press enough for it to be okay, and that's what we did. And we did, however, do a couple things together where we, co-paid for the printing of stuff. A couple issues we did that, and that was fun. So,
now,
yeah, but technically, Spit and Half wasn't really like a publisher of mine, but even though things came out with that label on it, it's not in the traditional sense of a publisher. But yeah, I did put down that it was published by Spit and Half. It's kind of confusing, but it makes sense to me.
I was just wondering, the Silly Daddy collection, how much of Silly Daddy is actually in here? Is it most of it?
Yeah, it's most of it. Up to 2004, it's most of it, except for a couple issues that were just totally immoral and offensive. Like, there's whole issues that there's nothing in there. Like, from, I think, there's two issues in particular that were outside of I'd say the Silly Daddy Continuum, where you don't even notice that they're gone. So I took those out, and I think there may have been a couple other pages that I couldn't save, I couldn't redraw, and those are gone. But again, without them, and this is what's so great, is it turns out you didn't need them to tell the story. And I think that's the case with a lot of great work. You can do some great things, and it doesn't have to be offensive. You can feel good about reading it if your 5-year-old son is looking over your shoulder and not having to worry about, is this something I shouldn't be looking at, or my son shouldn't be looking at, because he'll be tainted, and I feel a lot better about that. I did that.
Tell us about your other two kids.
Well,
we've talked about Maria, but yeah, you are the silly daddy.
Yeah.
So who are the silly children?
So yeah, actually nowadays most of the funny stuff comes from it still comes from all of them, I guess. Yeah, it does. But a lot of it comes from Luke, who's now 6, and I think in the heyday of my most crank and silly daddy period, where I kind of hit a peak, was when Maria was 6, and actually Luke is 6 now, and he just says funny things left and right almost daily. So he's just, an incredible wealth of material there. And so just to make sure I had enough material, we also had Anna a year and a half ago. So now we have a 18-month-old baby, Anna, and she's also super cute and super funny. So yeah, they're great kids, and I just feel totally blessed by God to just have kids that they just appreciate being together. And there's challenges with being a parent, but boy, I wouldn't trade them for the world. They're awesome.
Now, we're nearing the end of our time. I think, do you have something? You look like you're about to say something, Colin.
No, I was just wondering if you ever thought of training them to work as art assistants.
You know what? I have. I'd love to have a Silly Daddy House of Ideas, cranking out stuff. That'd be cool. But really, it's more of what do they want to do? What do they want to make of their lives? As long as I could really teach them that they need to make sure that they have a relationship with God, a solid one, I feel good about that. And if we can work together and collaborate on comics too, that'd be awesome too. Like, for example, Maria did a song for one of my comics. She sung The Sound of Music to one of the comics as a supplemental thing. You can find that, I think, on the website. She's got an amazing voice, Maria does. She sings. Things like an angel, just like mm-hmm. The Simpsons say. And then Luke has colored some of my stuff. Actually, nowadays Denise colors most of my stuff. And Anna, right now we just have to keep everything away from Anna. I'm not sure what she's going to do.
Start eating the paper.
That's known to happen. Yeah.
Well,
now if I had a kid, I'd raise a Gerhard. Someone to do the backgrounds.
There we go.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Well, thanks for taking the time to join us today, Joe.
Oh, I really appreciate it, guys.
And I hope you have a lovely day. I don't know what the weather's like in Chicago, but it's not very nice here.
Yeah, it's raining too, but thanks again, guys. And I appreciate all you Canadians.
Okay, thanks.
All right, bye.
Good day.
Canadians don't really say good day, Colin.
I'm working on it.
He's working on it. Colin, creating a new dialogue of Canadian words.
Well, what do Canadians say? How's it going, eh?
Hey.
Eh?
I'm a real hoser, eh?
Oh, God, not that again.
Oh, you don't want me to do the Bob and Doug McKenzie thing?
We could do it together, but not.
No. Yeah. No, we're not that Canadian. And also, I would need to see you drink a beer before I let you do a Bob and Doug McKenzie thing in front of me.
I will eat donuts if pressed.
I don't even think you need to be pressed for that. I'll eat donuts for anything. I'll eat a donut to make a child cry. Colin didn't like that one.
That made me sad.
It made him sad. It's been a while since we've actually been on air live. Last couple of weeks, we've mm-hmm. been having pre-recorded interviews. It's been a busy time for the Ink Studs lately. Next week, I'm very excited, is Jim Blanchard will be joining me and Luke Meat, the music director for CITR will be coming in.
Oh.
And the always curmudgeoned Don King will be in to rant on his tangents.
You got to be careful. That Jim Blanchard, he's kind of intense.
I think he's quite interesting. Really fascinating artist.
An amazing, skillful artist.
Oh, he's super talented. Beasts and Priests is his latest book for Fantagraphics. It's gorgeous. It's like he's got this really neat pop intensity. It's just gorgeous. And he also, for those that you know need a reference point, he inked
him about
hate for
burning
years.
Down a fence. I think that was Jim at a party, a Fantagraphics party, where we smashed up a fence and burned it up.
I think they've done more than that at Fantagraphics party.
Put it this way, I don't think Jim Blanchard is the kind of person who's ever going to go back to his back catalog and take out the swearing.
No. No, he won't. And then the week after that, I'll be airing an interview I did with Robert Dayton, where we talked to Kim Deitch, past, it's wonderful. Most intensive interview you'll find with Kim Deitch. I think it's, I'm really blown away by Kim.
Is this
Kim
a two-parter?
What's going to happen is actually it's 2.5 hours straight of us talking with Kim.
Wow.
Wow. Wow, indeed. Longest interview I've ever done. The closest to that was Ralph Steadman, but Kim Deitch, wow. His quote throughout the thing, in for a penny, in for a pound. So he was ready for 2.5 hours, and we probably could have gone for longer, but I think we were wearing the poor man down. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play the first hour on the radio, mixed with some music of Kim's choice. He's mailing me some stuff. I'm very excited. He's got a neat selection of stuff of early kind of vaudevillian 1920s, 1930s.
Well, judging from his
jazz.
Work, that's exactly what I would expect.
Yeah, he's really fascinating guy, really interesting. He was there at the cusp of all this incredible stuff, and he's doing the best work of his career right now. Boulevard of Broken Dreams, incredible. Everyone needs to read that book. Like, that is, it's a Jimmy Corrigan of comics.
What's the name of the latest one?
Alias the Cat.
Alias the Cat.
Alias the Cat is excellent, from Pantheon Books. Yeah. And the same people that put out the Boulevard of Broken Dreams. Great. And also Shadowland from Fantagraphics is quite excellent as well.
He really has, over the years, been able to create his own world, hasn't he?
Yeah. It's incredible. I'm just going to keep saying it's incredible. It's incredible.
In for a penny, in for a pound.
In for a penny, in for a pound. So I think we'll have some more underground comic artists we're going to be talking to, because that's something I really want to concentrate on, is talking to underground people.
Well, in the future, we're hopefully going to have an interview with Brian Talbot.
Yeah, I need to contact him back.
Who started out in – he's one of the leading figures in British underground comics. His first comic was published by a head shop in London, and he recently put out Alice in Sunderland, which is an amazing book.
Fantastic. I noticed that my boys from Crimes and Treasons are here, so I will round up the show to say a week after that I'll have a surprise show. It won't necessarily be comic-related, but it'll be an extremely interesting interview nonetheless. And on the 16th of August, I'll be joined by Farrell Dalrymple, Portland's own talented boy, who Pop Gun War is his great book, and he's doing a Omega the Unknown or something like that for Marvel come this fall, which will be colored by Paul Hornschmeier, who is one of my favorite cartoonists out there. Just great muted tones. And August 23rd, we will be joined, or 23rd. August 23rd. Colin and I will have an interesting conversation with Jeet here and Chris Ware discussing Frank King, Gasoline Alley, Walton Skeezix, and more. I'm very excited about that.
One of the classics.
One of the classics. It's a beautiful book. It's a really, really beautiful book.
Chris Ware, did he do the design?
Yeah. Yeah, you look at the Walton Skeezix books and you can see the influence that he's had on Chris Ware. One of my favorite quotes is a cartoonist going, "I love the Walton Skeezix book. But every time I look at it, I keep hoping it's a new Chris Ware book." Well, Chris Ware would blush on that note. It's an excellent, the Walton Skeezix stuff. It's really incredible. Like, I'm not a big fan of the comic strips, like the old strips, the old timeies. Like I think some of them are incredibly gorgeous, but Walton Cusick's just breeds so well. And this August, Sunday Press Books, I think that's the name of them, is putting out a Sunday's collection of Walton Cusick stuff.
Excellent.
$100. CITR 101.9 FM, Inkstuds, We Are Done, Crimes and Treasons up next. What?
And Joseph knew by this, his brothers now were honest men. The time had come.